major proposed physical laws were driven time and again to some version of parallel worlds. Let's now change tack. What happens if we seize the wheel? Can we humans manipulate the cosmic unfolding to volitionally create universes parallel to our own? If you believe, as I do, that the behavior of living beings is dictated by nature's laws, then you may see this as no change of tack at all, but simply as a narrowing of perspective to the impact of physical law when funneled through human activity. This line of thought quickly engages thorny issues such as the age-old debate about determinism and free will, but that's not a direction in which I want to head. Rather, my question is this. With the same sense of intent and control you feel when you choose a movie or a meal, might you create a universe? The question sounds outlandish, and it is. I'll tip you off now that in addressing it, we will find ourselves in territory even more speculative than what we've already covered, and considering where we've been, that says a lot. But let's have a little fun and see where it takes us. Let me lay out the perspective I'll take. In contemplating universe creation, I'm less interested in practical constraints than in the possibilities made available by the laws of physics. So, when I speak of you creating a universe, what I really mean is you or a distant descendant or an army of such descendants possibly millennia down the road. These present or future humans will still be subject to the laws of physics, but I will imagine that they're in possession of arbitrarily advanced technologies. I will also consider the creation of two distinct types of universes. The first type comprises the usual universes, ones that encompass an expanse of space and are filled with various forms of matter and energy. The second kind is less tangible, virtual, computer-generated universes. The discussion will also naturally forge a link to a third multiverse proposal. This variety does not originate from thinking about universe creation per se, but instead addresses the question of whether mathematics is real or is instead created by the mind. To create a universe. Despite uncertainties in delineating the composition of the universe, what is the dark energy? What is the full list of fundamental particulate ingredients? Scientists are confident that were you to weigh everything that's within our cosmic horizon, the tally would come in at about 10 billion, 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 billion grams. If the contents weighed significantly more or less than this, their gravitational influence on the pattern of hot and cold regions in the microwave background radiation would conflict with observations. But the precise weight of the observable universe is secondary. My point is that it's huge. So huge that the notion of us humans creating another such realm seems utterly fatuous. Using Big Bang cosmology as our blueprint for universe formation, we find no guidance on how to clear this hurdle. In the standard Big Bang theory, the observable universe was ever smaller at ever earlier times, but the stupendous quantities of matter and energy we now measure were always present. They were just squeezed into an ever smaller volume. If you want a universe like the one we see today, you have to start with raw material whose mass and energy are those we see today. The Big Bang theory takes such raw material as an unexplained given. In broad strokes, then, the Big Bang's instructions for creating a universe like ours require that we gather a gargantuan amount of mass and compress it to a fantastically small size. But having achieved that, however improbable, we would face another challenge. How do we ignite the bang? It's an obstacle that becomes only more daunting when we recall that the Big Bang is not an explosion that takes place within a static region of space. The Big Bang propels the expansion of space itself. If the Big Bang theory were the pinnacle of cosmological thought, the scientific pursuit of universe creation would stop here. But it's not. We've learned that the Big Bang theory has given way to the more robust inflationary cosmology. and inflation offers a strategy for going forward. With a powerful outward burst of spatial expansion being its trademark, the inflationary theory puts a bang in the Big Bang, and a big one at that. According to inflation, an anti-gravity blast is what set the outward expansion of space in motion. Of equal importance, as we will now discuss, inflation establishes that vast amounts of matter can be created from the most modest of seeds. Recall from Chapter 3 that in the inflationary approach, a universe like ours, a hole in the cosmic Swiss cheese, formed when the inflaton's value rolled down its potential energy curve, bringing to a close the phenomenal outward surge in our vicinity. As the inflaton's value dropped, the energy it contained was transformed into a bath of particles uniformly filling our bubble. That's where the matter we see originated. Progress, for sure, but the insight raises the next question. What's the source of the inflaton's energy? It comes from gravity. Remember that inflationary expansion is much like viral replication. A high-valued inflaton field drives the region it inhabits to rapidly grow, and in doing so, creates an increasingly large spatial volume that is itself infused with a high-valued inflaton field. And because a uniform inflaton field contributes a constant energy per unit volume, the larger the volume it fills, the more energy it embodies. The driving force behind the expansion is gravity in its repulsive guise, and so gravity is the source of the ever larger energy the region contains. Inflationary cosmology can thus be thought of as creating a sustained energy flow from the gravitational field to the inflaton field. This might seem like one more passing of the energy buck. Where does gravity get its energy? But the situation is a good deal better than that. Gravity is different from the other forces because where there's gravity, there's a virtually unlimited reservoir of energy. It's a familiar idea expressed in unfamiliar language. When you jump off a cliff, your kinetic energy, the energy of your motion, gets ever larger. Gravity, the force driving your motion, is the energy source. In any realistic situation, you will hit the ground. But in principle, you could fall arbitrarily far, tumbling down an increasingly long rabbit hole while your kinetic energy grows ever larger. The reason gravity can supply such unlimited quantities of energy is that, much like the U.S. Treasury, it has no fear of debt. As you fall and your energy gets ever more positive, gravity compensates by its energy becoming ever more negative. You know intuitively that the gravitational energy is negative because to climb out of the rabbit hole, you need to exert positive energy, pushing with your legs, pulling with your arms. That's how you repay the energy debt gravity incurred on your behalf. The essential conclusion is that as an inflaton-filled region rapidly grows, the inflaton extracts energy from the gravitational field's inexhaustible resources, resulting in the region's energy rapidly growing too. And because the inflaton field supplies the energy that's converted into ordinary matter, inflationary cosmology, unlike the Big Bang model, does not need to posit the raw material for generating planets, stars, and galaxies. Gravity is matter's sugar daddy. The only independent energy budget required by inflationary cosmology is what's needed to create an initial inflationary seed, a small spherical nugget of space with a high-valued inflaton field that gets inflationary expansion rolling in the first place. When you put in numbers, the equations show that the nugget need only be about 10 to the minus 26 centimeters across and filled with an inflaton field whose energy, when converted to mass, would weigh less than 10 grams. Such a tiny seed would, faster than a flash, undergo spectacular expansion, growing far larger than the observable universe while harboring ever-increasing energy. The inflaton's total energy would quickly soar beyond what's necessary to generate all the stars and all the galaxies we observe. And so, with inflation, in the cosmological driver's seat, the impossible starting point of the Big Bang's recipe. Gather more than 10 to the 55 grams and squeeze the whole lot into an infinitesimally small speck, is radically transformed. Gather 10 grams of inflaton field and squeeze it into a lump that's about 10 to the minus 26 centimeters across. That's a lump you could put in your wallet. This approach, nevertheless, presents daunting challenges. For one thing, the inflaton remains a purely hypothetical field. Cosmologists freely incorporate the inflaton field into their equations, but unlike with electron and quark fields, there's as yet no evidence that the inflaton field exists. For another, even if the inflaton proves real, and even if one day we develop the means to manipulate it, much as we do the electromagnetic field, still the density of the requisite inflaton seed would be enormous, about 10 to the 67 times that of an atomic nucleus. Although the seed would weigh less than a handful of popcorn, the compressive force we would need to apply is trillions and trillions of times beyond what we can now muster. But this is just the kind of technological hurdle that we're imagining an arbitrarily advanced civilization might one day overcome. So if our distant descendants one day harness the inflaton field and develop extraordinary compressors capable of producing such dense nuggets, will we have attained the status of universe creators? And as we contemplate such a step toward Olympus, should we worry that if we artificially set off new inflationary realms, our own corner of space may be swallowed by the ballooning expanse? Alan Guth and a number of collaborators investigated these questions in a series of papers and found both good news and bad. Start with the last question, as that's where we'll find the good news. Guth, together with Stephen Blau and Eduardo Gundelman, showed that there's no need to be concerned about an artificial phase of inflationary expansion ripping through our existing environment. The reason has to do with pressure. If an inflationary seed were created in the laboratory, it would harbor the inflaton field's characteristic positive energy and negative pressure. But it would be surrounded by ordinary space in which the inflaton field's value and its pressure would be zero, or nearly so. We usually don't ascribe much power to zero, but in this case, zero makes all the difference. Zero pressure is larger than negative pressure, and so the pressure outside the seed would be larger than the pressure inside. This would subject the seed to a net external force pressing upon it, much like what your eardrums experience when deep sea diving. It is the pressure differential that would prevent the seed from expanding into the surrounding environment. But this does not impede the inflaton's drive to expand. If you blow air into a balloon while tightly clasping its surface, the balloon will bubble out from between your hands. The inflaton seed can behave similarly. The seed can generate a new expanding spatial realm that sprouts from the original spatial environment. The calculations show that once the new expanding realm reaches a critical size, its umbilical cord to the parent space severs, and an independent, inflating universe is born. As enticing as the process might be, the artificial creation of a new universe, the view from the laboratory wouldn't live up to the advance billing. It's a relief that the inflationary bubble would not gobble up the surrounding environment, but the flip side is that there would be little evidence of the creation itself. A universe that expands by generating new space, which then detaches from ours, is a universe we can't see. Indeed, as the new universe pinches off, its sole residue would be a deep gravitational well, which would appear to us as a black hole. And since we have no capacity to see beyond a black hole's edge, we wouldn't even be assured that our experiment had been a success. Without access to the new universe, we would have no means of establishing observationally that the universe had been created at all. Physics protects us, but the price for safety is total separation from our handiwork. And that's the good news. The bad news for aspiring universe creators is a more sobering result derived by Guth and his MIT colleague, Edward Farhi. Their careful mathematical treatment showed that such universe creation requires an additional ingredient. Much as some balloons require that you give a strong initial burst of air, after which they more easily inflate, Guth and Farhi found that the tiny, nascent universe needs a strong kickstart to get the inflationary expansion off and running. So strong that there's only one entity that can provide it, a white hole. A white hole, the opposite of a black hole, is a hypothetical object that spews matter out rather than drawing it in. This requires conditions so extreme that known mathematical methods break down, much as is the case at the center of a black hole. Suffice it to say, no one anticipates generating white holes in the laboratory, ever. Guth and Farhi found a fundamental wrench in the works of universe creation. A number of research groups have since suggested possible ways of skirting the problem. Guth and Farhi, joined by Jamal Guven, found that by creating the inflationary seed through a quantum tunneling process, similar to what we discussed in the context of the landscape multiverse, the white hole singularity can be avoided. But the probability for the quantum tunneling process to happen turns out to be so fantastically small that there's essentially no chance of it happening over timescales that anyone would consider worth contemplating. A group of Japanese physicists, Nobuyuki Sakai, Kenichi Nakao, Hideki Ishihara, and Makoto Kobayashi, showed that a magnetic monopole, a hypothetical particle that has either the north pole or the south pole of a standard bar magnet, might catalyze inflationary expansion, also avoiding singularities. But after nearly 40 years of intense searching, no one has yet found a single one of these particles. As of today, then, the summary is that the door to creating new universes remains open, but only barely. Given the proposal's heavy reliance on hypothetical elements, future developments may well shut this door permanently. But if they don't, or perhaps if subsequent work makes a stronger case for the possibility of universe creation, would there be motivation to proceed? Why create a universe if there's no way to see it, or interact with it, or even know for sure that it was created? Andre Lindy, famous not just for his deep cosmological insights, but also for his flair for mock drama, has noted that the allure of playing God would simply prove irresistible. I don't know that it would. Admittedly, it would be thrilling to have so thoroughly grasped nature's laws that we could reenact the most pivotal of all events. I suspect, however, that by the time we can seriously consider universe creation, if that time ever comes, our scientific and technical advancements would have made available so many other spectacular undertakings, whose results we could not just imagine, but truly experience, that the intangible nature of universe creation would make it much less interesting. The appeal would surely be stronger were we to learn how to manufacture universes that we could see or even interact with. For real universes, in the usual sense of a universe constituted from the standard ingredients of space, time, matter, and energy, we don't yet have any strategy for doing so that's compatible with the laws of physics as we currently understand them. But what if we set aside real universes and consider virtual ones? The stuff of thought. A couple of years ago, I had a bout of feverish flu that came with hallucinations far more vivid than any ordinary dream or nightmare. In one that has stayed with me, I'd find myself with a group of people sitting in a sparse hotel room, locked in a hallucination within the hallucination. I was absolutely certain that days and weeks went by until I was thrust back into the primary hallucination, where I'd learned, shockingly, that hardly any time had passed at all. Each time I felt myself drifting back to the room, I resisted strenuously, since I knew from previous iterations that once there, I'd be swallowed whole, unable to recognize the realm as false, until I found myself back in the primary hallucination, where I'd again be distraught to learn that what I'd thought real was illusory. Periodically, when the fever subsided, I'd pull out one level further back to ordinary life and realize that all those translocations had been taking place within my own swirling mind. I don't usually learn much from having a fever, but this experience added immediacy to something which, to that point, I'd largely understood only in the abstract. Our grip on reality is more tenuous than day-to-day life can lead us to believe. Modify normal brain function just a bit, and the bedrock of reality may suddenly shift. Though the outside world remains stable, our perception of it does not. This raises a classic philosophical question. Since all of our experiences are filtered and analyzed by our respective brains, how sure are we that our experiences reflect what's real? In the framing philosophers like to use, how do you know you're listening to the sentence and not floating in a vat on a distant planet with alien scientists stimulating your brain to produce the thoughts and experiences you deem real? These issues are central to epistemology, a philosophical subfield that asks what constitutes knowledge, how we acquire it, and how sure we are that we have it. Popular culture has brought these scholarly pursuits to a wide audience in films such as The Matrix, The 13th Floor, and Vanilla Sky, tussling with them in entertaining and thought-provoking ways. So in looser language, the question we're asking is this: how do you know you're not hooked into the Matrix? The bottom line is that you can't know for sure. You engage the world through your senses, which stimulate your brain in ways your neural circuitry has evolved to interpret. If someone artificially stimulates your brain so as to elicit electrical crackles exactly like those produced by eating pizza, listening to the sentence, or skydiving, the experience will be indistinguishable from the real thing. Experience is dictated by brain processes, not by what activates those processes. Going a step further, we can consider dispensing with the sloppiness of biological material altogether. Might all your thoughts and experiences be nothing more than a simulation that leverages software and circuitry sufficiently elaborate to mimic ordinary brain function? Are you convinced of the reality of flesh, blood, and the physical world when actually your experience is only a crowd of electrical impulses firing through a hyper-advanced supercomputer? An immediate challenge in considering such scenarios is that they easily set off a spiraling skeptical collapse. We wind up trusting nothing, not even our powers of deductive reasoning. My first response to questions like the ones just posed is to work out how much computer power you'd need to stand a chance of simulating a human brain. But if I am indeed part of such a simulation, why should I believe anything I read in neurobiology texts? The books would be simulations too, written by simulated biologists whose findings would be dictated by the software running the simulation, and thus could easily be irrelevant to the workings of real brains. The very notion of a real brain might itself be computer-generated artifice. Once you can't trust your knowledge base, reality quickly sails to sea. We'll return to these concerns, but I don't want them to sink us, at least not yet. So for the time being, let's drop anchor. Imagine that you are real flesh and blood, and so am I, and that everything you and I take to be real, in the everyday sense of the term, is real. With all that assumed, let's take up the question of computers and brain power. What, roughly, is the processing speed of the human brain, and how does it compare with the capacity of computers? Even if we are not stuck in a skeptical morass, this is a difficult question. Brain function is largely an uncharted territory. But just to get a glimpse of the terrain, however foggy, consider some numbers. The human retina, a thin slab of 100 million neurons that's smaller than a dime and about as thick as a few sheets of paper, is one of the best-studied neuronal clusters. The robotics researcher Hans Moravec has estimated that for a computer-based retinal system to be on par with that of humans, it would need to execute about a billion operations each second. To scale up from the retina's volume to that of the entire brain requires a factor of about 100,000. Moravec suggests that effectively simulating a brain would thus require a comparable increase in processing power for a total of about 100 million million, 10 to the 14, operations per second. Independent estimates based on the number of synapses in the brain and their typical firing rates yield processing speeds within a few orders of magnitude of this result, about 10 to the 17 operations per second. Although it's difficult to be more precise, this gives a sense of the numbers that come into play. The computer I'm now using has a speed that's about a billion operations per second. Today's fastest supercomputers have a peak speed of about 10 to the 15 operations per second, a statistic that no doubt will quickly date this book. If we use the faster estimate for brain speed, we find that 100 million laptops or 100 supercomputers approach the processing power of a human brain. Such comparisons are likely naive. The mysteries of the brain are manifold, and speed is only one gross measure of function. But most everyone agrees that one day we will have raw computing capacity equal to and likely far in excess of what biology has provided. Futurists contend that such technological leaps will yield a world so far beyond familiar experience that we lack the capacity to imagine what it will be like. Invoking an analogy with phenomena that lie outside the bounds of our most refined physical theories, they call this visionary roadblock a singularity. One broad-brush prognosis holds that the surpassing of brain power by computers will completely blur the boundary between humans and technology. Some anticipate a world run rampant with thinking and feeling machines, while those of us still based in old-fashioned biology routinely upload our brain content, safely storing knowledge and personalities in silico, complete with backup drives for unlimited durations. This vision may well be hyperbolic. There's little dispute regarding projections of computer power, but the obvious unknown is whether we will ever leverage such power into a radical fusion of mind and machine. It's a modern-day question with ancient roots. We've been thinking about thinking for thousands of years. How is it that the external world generates our internal responses? Is your sensation of color the same as mine? How about your sensations of sound and touch? What exactly is that voice we hear in our heads, the stream of internal chatter we call our conscious selves? Does it derive from purely physical processes, or does consciousness arise from a layer of reality that transcends the physical? Penetrating thinkers through the ages, Plato and Aristotle, Hobbes and Descartes, Hume and Kant, Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, James and Freud, Wittgenstein and Turing, among countless others, have tried to illuminate or debunk processes that animate the mind and create the singular inner life available through introspection. A great many theories of mind have emerged, differing in ways significant and subtle. We won't need the finer points, but just to get a feel for where the trails have led, here are a few. Dualist theories, of which there are many varieties, maintain that there is an essential non-physical component vital to mind. Physicalist theories of mind, of which there are also many varieties, deny this, emphasizing instead that underlying each unique subjective experience is a unique brain state. Functionalist theories go further in this direction, suggesting that what really matters to making a mind are the processes and functions, the circuits, their interconnections, their relationships, and not the particulars of the physical medium within which these processes take place. Physicalists would largely agree that were you to faithfully replicate my brain by whatever means, molecule by molecule, atom by atom, the end product would indeed think and feel as I do. Functionalists would largely agree that were you to focus on higher level structures, replicating all my brain connections, preserving all brain processes while changing only the physical substrate through which they occur, the same conclusion would hold. Dualists would largely disagree on both counts. The possibility of artificial sentience clearly relies on a functionalist viewpoint. A central assumption of this perspective is that conscious thought is not overlaid on a brain, but rather is the very sensation generated by a particular kind of information processing. Whether that processing happens within a 4-pound biological mass or within the circuits of a computer is irrelevant. The assumption could be wrong. Maybe a bundle of connections needs a substrate of wrinkled wet matter if it is to gain self-awareness. Maybe you need the actual physical molecules that constitute a brain, not just the processes and connections those molecules facilitate if conscious thought is to animate the inanimate. Maybe the kinds of information processing that computers carry out will always differ in some essential way from brain functioning, preventing the leap to sentience. Maybe conscious thought is fundamentally non-physical, as claimed by various traditions, and so lies permanently beyond the reach of technological innovation. With the rise of ever more sophisticated technologies, the questions have become sharper and the pathway toward answers more tangible. A number of research groups has already taken the initial steps towards simulating a biological brain on a computer. For example, the Blue Brain Project, a joint venture between IBM and the École Polytechnique Fédérale in Lausanne, Switzerland, is dedicated to modeling brain function on IBM's fastest supercomputer. BlueJean, as the supercomputer is called, is a more powerful version of Deep Blue, the computer that triumphed in 1997 over the world chess champion Garry Kasparov. BlueBrain's approach is not all that different from the scenarios I just described. Through painstaking anatomical studies of real brains, researchers are gathering ever more precise insight into the cellular, genetic, and molecular structure of neurons and their interconnections. The project aims to encode such understanding, for now mostly at the cellular level, in digital models simulated by the BlueJean computer. To date, researchers have drawn on results from tens of thousands of experiments focused on a pinhead-sized section of a rat brain, the neocortical column, to develop a three-dimensional computer simulation of roughly 10,000 neurons communicating through some 10 million interconnections. Comparisons between the response of a real rat's neocortical column and the computer simulation to the same stimuli show an encouraging fidelity of the synthetic model. This is far from the 100 billion neurons firing away in a typical human head, but the project's leader, the neuroscientist Henry Markram, anticipates that before 2020, the Blue Brain Project, leveraging processing speeds that are projected to increase by a factor of more than a million, will achieve a full simulated model of the human brain. BlueBrain's goal is not to produce artificial sentience, but rather to have a new investigative tool for developing treatments for various forms of mental illness. Still, Markram has gone out on a limb to speculate that, when completed, BlueBrain may very well have the capacity to speak and to feel. Regardless of the outcome, such hands-on explorations are pivotal to our theories of mind. I'm quite certain that the issue of which, if any, of the competing perspectives are on target cannot be settled through purely hypothetical speculation. In practice, too, challenges are immediately evident. Suppose a computer one day professes to be sentient. How would we know whether it really is? I can't even verify such claims of sentience when made by my wife, nor she with me. That's a burden arising from consciousness being a private affair. But because our human interactions yield abundant circumstantial evidence supporting the sentience of others, solipsism quickly becomes absurd. Computer interactions may one day reach a similar point. Conversing with computers, consoling and cajoling them, may one day convince us that the simplest explanation for their apparent conscious self-awareness is that they are indeed conscious and self-aware. Let's take a functionalist viewpoint and see where it leads. Simulated universes. If we ever create computer-based sentience, some would likely implant the thinking machines in artificial human bodies, creating a mechanical species, robots, that would be integrated into conventional reality. But my interest here is in those who would be drawn by the purity of electrical impulses to program simulated environments populated by simulated beings that would exist within a computer's hardware. Instead of C-3PO or Data, think Sims or Second Life, but with inhabitants who have self-aware and responsive minds. The history of technological innovation suggests that, iteration by iteration, the simulations would gain verisimilitude, allowing the physical and experiential characteristics of the artificial worlds to reach convincing levels of nuance and realism. Whoever was running a given simulation would decide whether the simulated beings knew that they existed within a computer. Simulated humans who surmised that their world was an elaborate computer program might find themselves taken away by simulated technicians in white coats and confined to simulated lock wards. But probably, the vast majority of simulated beings would consider the possibility that they're in a computer simulation too silly to warrant attention. You may well be having that very reaction right now. Even if you accept the possibility of artificial sentience, you may be persuaded that the overwhelming complexity of simulating an entire civilization, or just a smaller community, renders such feats beyond computational reach. On this point, it's worth looking at some more numbers. Our distant descendants will likely fashion ever larger quantities of matter into vast computing networks. So allow imagination free rein. Think big. Scientists have estimated that a present-day high-speed computer the size of the Earth could perform anywhere from 10 to the 33 to 10 to the 42 operations per second. By comparison, if we assume that our earlier estimate of 10 to the 17 operations per second for a human brain is on target, then an average brain performs about 10 to the 24 total operations in a single 100-year lifespan. Multiply that by the roughly 100 billion people who have ever walked the planet, and the total number of operations performed by every human brain since Lucy, my archaeology friends tell me I should say Ardy, is about 10 to the 35. Using the conservative estimate of 10 to the 33 operations per second, we see that the collective computational capacity of the human species could be achieved with a run of less than 2 minutes on an Earth-sized computer. And that's with today's technology. Quantum computing, harnessing all the distinct possibilities represented in a quantum probability wave so as to do many different calculations simultaneously, has the capacity to increase processing speeds by spectacular factors. Although we are still very far from mastering this application of quantum mechanics, researchers have estimated that a quantum computer no bigger than a laptop has the potential to perform the equivalent of all human thought since the dawn of our species in a tiny fraction of a second. To simulate not just individual minds, but also their interactions among themselves and with an evolving environment, the computational load would grow orders of magnitude larger. But a sophisticated simulation could cut computational corners with minimal impact on quality. Simulated humans on a simulated Earth won't be bothered if the computer simulates only things lying within the cosmic horizon. We can't see beyond that range, so the computer can safely ignore it. More boldly, the simulation might simulate stars beyond the sun only during simulated nights, and then only when the simulated local weather resulted in clear skies. When no one's looking, the computer's celestial simulator routines could take a break from working out the appropriate stimulus to provide each and every person who could look skyward. A sufficiently well-structured program would keep track of the mental states and intentions of its simulated inhabitants, and so would anticipate and appropriately respond to any impending stargazing. The same goes for simulating cells, molecules, and atoms. For the most part, they'd be necessary only for simulated specialists of one scientific persuasion or another, and then only when such specialists were in the act of studying these exotic realms. A computationally cheaper replica of familiar reality that adjusts the simulation's degree of detail on an as-needed basis would be adequate. Such simulated worlds would forcefully realize Wheeler's vision of information's primacy. Generate circuits that carry the right information, and you've generated parallel realities that are as real to their inhabitants as this one is to us. These simulations constitute our eighth variety of multiverse, which I'll call the simulated multiverse. Are you living in a simulation? The idea that universes might be simulated on computers has a long history, dating as far back as suggestions made in the 1960s by the computer pioneer Conrad Suse and the digital guru Edward Fredkin. I worked at IBM during 5 summers spanning college and graduate school. My boss, the late John Koch, himself a revered computer specialist, spoke frequently of Fredkin's view that the universe was nothing but a giant computer chugging along, executing something akin to cosmic Fortran. The idea struck me as taking the digital paradigm to a ridiculous extreme. Through the years, I hardly gave it a thought, until I encountered, much more recently, a simple but curious conclusion by the Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom. To appreciate Bostrom's point, one that Moravec had also hinted at, begin with a straightforward comparison: the difficulty of creating a real universe versus the difficulty of creating a simulated universe. To create a real one, as we've discussed, presents enormous obstacles. And if we succeeded, the resulting universe would be beyond our ability to see, which invites the question of what motivated us to create it in the first place. The creation of a simulated universe is a wholly different enterprise. The march toward increasingly powerful computers running ever more sophisticated programs is inexorable. Even with today's rudimentary technology, the fascination of creating simulated environments is strong. With more capability, it's hard to imagine anything but more intense interest. The question is not whether our descendants will create simulated computer worlds. We're already doing it. The unknown is how realistic the worlds will become. Should there be an inherent obstacle to generating artificial sentience, all bets are off. But Bostrom, assuming that realistic simulations prove possible, makes a simple observation. Our descendants are bound to create an immense number of simulated universes, filled with a great many self-aware, conscious inhabitants. If someone can come home at night, kick back, and fire up the Create a Universe software, it's easy to envision that they'll not only do so, but do so often. Think about what this scenario might entail. One future day, a cosmic census that takes account of all sentient beings might find that the number of flesh and blood humans pales in comparison with those made of chips and bytes, or their future equivalents. And, Bostrom reasons, if the ratio of simulated humans to real humans were colossal, then brute statistics suggest that we are not in a real universe. The odds would overwhelmingly favor the conclusion that you and I and everyone else are living within a simulation, perhaps one created by future historians with a fascination for what life was like back on 21st century Earth. You may object that we have now run headlong into the skeptical quicksand we planned at the outset to avoid. Once we conclude that there's a high likelihood that we're living in a computer simulation, how do we trust anything, including the very reasoning that led to the conclusion? Well, our confidence in a great many things might diminish. Will the sun rise tomorrow? Maybe, as long as whoever is running the simulation doesn't pull the plug. Are all our memories trustworthy? They seem so, but whoever is at the keyboard may have a penchant for adjusting them from time to time. Nevertheless, Bostrom notes, the conclusion that we're in a simulation does not fully sever our grasp on the true underlying reality. Even if we believe that we're in a simulation, we can still identify one feature that the underlying reality definitely possesses. It allows for realistic computer simulations. After all, according to our belief, we're in one. The unbridled skepticism generated by the suspicion that we're simulated aligns with that very knowledge and so fails to undermine it. While it was useful when we began to weigh anchor and declare the reality of all that seems real, it wasn't necessary. Logic alone can't ensure that we're not in a computer simulation. The only way to dodge the conclusion that we're likely living in a simulation is to leverage intrinsic weaknesses in the reasoning. Maybe sentience can't be simulated, full stop. Or maybe, as Bostrom also notes, civilizations en route to the technological mastery necessary to create sentient simulations will inevitably turn that technology inward and destroy themselves. Or maybe, when our distant descendants gain the capacity to create simulated universes, they choose not to do so, perhaps for moral reasons, or simply because other, currently inconceivable pursuits prove so much more interesting that, much as we noted with universe creation, universe simulation falls by the wayside. These are among numerous loopholes, but whether they're large enough for the proverbial truck to drive through, who knows? If not, you might want to spice up your life a bit. Make your mark. Whoever is running the simulation is bound to get tired of wallflowers. Being a cynosure would seem a likely path toward longevity. Seeing beyond a simulation. If you were living in a simulation, could you figure that out? The answer depends in no small part on who is running your simulation. Call him or her the simulator, and the manner in which your simulation was programmed. The simulator, for instance, might choose to let you in on the secret. One day, while taking a shower, you might hear a gentle ding-ding, and when you cleared the shampoo from your eyes, you'd see a floating window in which your smiling simulator would appear and introduce herself. Or maybe this revelation would happen on a worldwide scale, with giant windows and a booming voice surrounding the planet, announcing that there is, in fact, an all-powerful programmer up in the heavens. But even if your simulator shied away from exhibitionism, less obvious clues might turn up. Simulations allowing for sentient beings would certainly have reached a minimum fidelity threshold. But as they do with designer clothes and cheap knockoffs, quality and consistency would likely vary. For example, one approach to programming simulations, call it the emergent strategy, would draw on the accumulated mass of human knowledge, judiciously invoking relevant perspectives as dictated by context. Collisions between protons in particle accelerators would be simulated using quantum field theory. The trajectory of a batted ball would be simulated using Newton's laws. The reactions of a mother watching her child's first steps would be simulated by melding insights from biochemistry, physiology, and psychology. The actions of governmental leaders would fold in political theory, history, and economics. Being a patchwork of approaches focused on different aspects of simulated reality, the emergent strategy would need to maintain internal consistency as processes nominally construed to lie in one realm spilled over into another. A psychiatrist needn't fully grasp the cellular, chemical, molecular, atomic, and subatomic processes underlying brain function, which is a good thing for psychiatry. But in simulating a person, the challenge for the emergent strategy would be to consistently meld coarse and fine levels of information, ensuring, for example, that emotional and cognitive functions interface sensibly with physiochemical data. This kind of cross-border meshing takes place in all phenomena and has always compelled science to seek deeper, more unified explanations. Simulators employing emergent strategies would have to iron out mismatches arising from the disparate methods, and they'd need to ensure that the meshing was smooth. This would require fiddles and tweaks, which, to an inhabitant, might appear as sudden, baffling changes to the environment with no apparent cause or explanation. And the meshing might fail to be fully effective. The resulting inconsistencies could build over time, perhaps becoming so severe that the world became incoherent and the simulation crashed. A possible way to obviate such challenges would be to use a different approach. Call it the ultra-reductionist strategy, in which the simulation would proceed by a single set of fundamental equations, much as physicists imagine is the case for the real universe. Such simulations would take as input a mathematical theory of matter and the fundamental forces, and a choice of initial conditions, how things were at the starting point of the simulation. The computer would then evolve everything forward in time, thereby avoiding the meshing issues of the emergent approach. But simulations of this kind would encounter their own computational problems, even beyond the staggering computational burden of simulating everything, right down to the behavior of individual particles. If the equations our descendants have in their possession are similar to those we work with today, involving numbers that can vary continuously, then the simulations would necessarily invoke approximations. To exactly follow a number as it varies continuously, we would need to track its value to an infinite number of decimal places. For instance, as such a quantity varies, say, from 0.9 to 1, it would pass through numbers like 0.9, 0.95, 0.958, 0.9583, 0.95831, 0.958317, and so on, with an arbitrarily large number of digits required for full accuracy. That's something a computer with finite resources can't manage. It will run out of time and memory. So even if the deepest equations were used, it's still possible that computer-based calculations would inevitably be approximate, allowing errors to build up over time. Of course, by error, I mean a deviation between what occurs in the simulation and the description inherent in the most refined physical theories the simulator has at his or her disposal. But to those like you who are within the simulation, the mathematical rules driving the computer would be your laws of nature. The issue then is not how closely the mathematical laws used by the computer model the external world. We're imagining that you don't observe the external world from within the simulation. Rather, the problem for a simulated universe is that when a computer's necessary approximations permeate otherwise exact mathematical equations, calculations easily lose their stability. Round-off errors, when accumulated over a great many computations, can yield inconsistencies. You and other simulated scientists might witness anomalous results from experiments. Cherrett's laws might start yielding inaccurate predictions. Measurements that had long since converged on a single, widely confirmed result might start producing different answers. For long stretches, you and your simulated colleagues would think that you'd encountered evidence, much as your forebears had throughout the previous centuries and millennia, that your final theory wasn't so final after all. Collectively, you'd closely re-examine the theory, perhaps coming up with new ideas, equations, and principles that better describe the data. But assuming that inaccuracies didn't result in contradictions that crashed the program, at some point you'd hit a wall. After an exhaustive search through possible explanations, none of which was able to fully explain what was happening, an iconoclastic thinker might suggest a radically different idea. If the continuum laws that physicists had developed over many millennia were input to a powerful digital computer and used to generate a simulated universe, the errors built up from the inherent approximations would yield anomalies of the very kind being observed. Are you suggesting that we're in a computer simulation, you'd ask? Yes, your colleague would answer. Well, that's nutty, you'd say. Really, she'd reply. Take a look. And she'd produce a monitor showing a simulated world, which she had programmed using those very same deep laws of physics. And, catching your breath after the shock of encountering a simulated world at all, you would see that the simulated scientists were indeed puzzling over the very same kind of strange data that troubled you. A simulator who sought more assiduously to conceal herself could, of course, use more aggressive tactics. As inconsistencies started to build, she might reset the program and erase the inhabitants' memory of the anomalies. So it would seem a stretch to claim that a simulated reality would reveal its true nature through glitches and irregularities. And certainly, I'd be hard-pressed to argue that inconsistencies, anomalies, unanswered questions, and stalled progress would reflect anything more than our own scientific failings. The sensible interpretation of such evidence would be that we scientists need to work harder and be more creative in seeking explanations. However, there is one serious conclusion that emerges from the fanciful scenario I've told. If and when we do generate simulated worlds with apparently sentient inhabitants, an essential question will arise. Is it reasonable to believe that we occupy a rarefied place in the history of scientific technological development, that we have become the very first creators of sentient simulations. We may have, but if we're keen to go with the odds, we must consider alternative explanations that, in the grand scheme of things, don't require us to be so extraordinary. And there is a ready-made explanation that fits the bill. Once our own work convinces us that sentient simulations are possible, the guiding principle of garden variety, discussed in Chapter 7, suggests that there's not just one such simulation out there, but a swarming ocean of simulations which constitute a simulated multiverse. While the simulation we've created might be a landmark feat in the limited domain to which we have access, within the context of the entire simulated multiverse, it's nothing special, having been achieved a gazillion times over. Once we accept that idea, we're led to consider that we, too, may be in a simulation, since that's the status of the vast majority of sentient beings in a simulated multiverse. Evidence for artificial sentience and for simulated worlds is grounds for rethinking the nature of your own reality. The Library of Babel. During my first semester in college, I enrolled in an introductory philosophy course taught by the late Robert Nozick. From the very first lecture, it was a wild ride. Nozick was completing his voluminous Philosophical Explanations. He used the course as a dress rehearsal for many of the book's central arguments. Just about every class shook my grasp on the world, sometimes vigorously. This was an unexpected experience. I thought that upending reality would be the purview solely of my physics courses. Yet there was an essential difference between the two. The physics lectures challenge comfortable views by exposing strange phenomena that arise in wholly unfamiliar realms where things move fast, are extremely heavy, or are fantastically tiny. The philosophy lecture shook comfortable views by challenging the foundations of everyday experience. How do we know there's a real world out there? Should we trust our perceptions? What thread binds our molecules and atoms to preserve our personal identity through time? While I was hanging around after class one day, Nozick asked me what I was interested in, and I brazenly told him that I wanted to work on quantum gravity and unified theories. This was generally a conversation stopper, but for Nozick it presented a chance to educate a young mind by revealing a new perspective. "What drives your interest?" he asked. I told him that I wanted to find eternal truths to help understand why things are the way they are. Naive and blustery, for sure. But Nozick listened graciously and then took the idea further. "Let's say you find the unified theory," he said. "Would that really provide the answers you're looking for? Wouldn't you still be left asking why that particular theory and not another was the correct theory of the universe?" He was right, of course, but I replied that in the search for explanations, there might come a point when we would just have to accept certain things as given. That was just where Nozick wanted me to go. In writing Philosophical Explanations, he had developed an alternative to this view. It's based on what he called the principle of fecundity, and is an attempt to frame explanations without accepting certain things as given, without, as Nozick explains it, accepting anything as brute force truth. The philosophical maneuver behind this trick is straightforward: defang the question. If you want to avoid explaining why one particular theory should be singled out over another, then don't single it out. Nozick suggests that we imagine we're part of a multiverse that comprises every possible universe. The multiverse would include not only the alternative evolutions emerging from the quantum multiverse, or the many bubble universes of the inflationary multiverse, or the possible stringy worlds of the brain or landscape multiverse. These multiverses wouldn't, on their own, fulfill Nozick's proposal because you'd still be left wondering why quantum mechanics, or why inflation, or why string theory. Instead, come up with any possible universe whatsoever. It could be made of the usual atomic species, But a universe made solely of melted mozzarella would serve just as well, and it has a place in Nozick's scheme. This is the last multiverse we will consider, since it's the most expansive of all, the most expansive possible. Any multiverse that's ever been or ever will be proposed is itself composed of possible universes, and will therefore be part of this mega conglomerate, which I'll call the ultimate multiverse. Within this framework, if you ask why our universe is governed by the laws our research reveals, the answer harks back to Anthropics. There are other universes out there, all possible universes, in fact, and we inhabit the one we do because it's among those that support our form of life. In the other universes where we could live, of which there are many, since, among other things, we can certainly survive sufficiently tiny changes to the various fundamental parameters of physics, there are people, much like us, asking the same question, and the same answer applies equally well to them. The point is that the attribute of existence affords a universe no special status, because in the ultimate multiverse, all possible universes do exist. The question of why one set of laws describes a real universe, ours, while all others are sterile abstractions, evaporates. There are no sterile laws. All sets of laws describe real universes. Curiously, Nozick noted that within his multiverse, there'd be a universe that consists of nothing, absolutely nothing, not empty space, but the nothing that Gottfried Leibniz referred to in his famous query, "Why is there something rather than nothing?" Not that Nozick could have known, but for me, this was an observation of particular resonance. When I was 10 or 11, I came upon Leibniz's question and found it deeply troubling. I'd pace my room, trying to grasp what nothing would be, often with one hand hovering behind the back of my head, thinking that the struggle to do the impossible, see my hand, would help me grasp the meaning of total absence. Even now, to focus on absolute, true nothingness makes my heart sink. Total nothingness, from our familiar vantage point of somethingness, entails the most profound loss. But because nothing also seems so vastly simpler than something, no laws at work, no matter at play, no space to inhabit, no time to unfurl, Leibniz's question strikes many as right on the mark. Why isn't there nothingness? Nothingness would have been decidedly elegant. In the ultimate multiverse, a universe consisting of nothing does exist. As far as we can tell, nothingness is a perfectly logical possibility, and so must be included in a multiverse that embraces all universes. Nozick's answer to Leibniz, then, is that in the ultimate multiverse, there is no imbalance between something and nothing that calls out for explanation. Universes of both types are part of this multiverse. A nothing universe is nothing to get exercised about. It's only because we humans are something that the nothing universe eludes us. A theoretician trained to speak in mathematics understands Nozick's all-encompassing multiverse as one where all possible mathematical equations are realized physically. It's a version of Jorge Luis Borges' story La Biblioteca de Babel, in which the books of Babel are written in the language of mathematics and so contain all possible sensible, non-self-contradictory strings of mathematical symbols. Some of the books would spell out familiar formulae, such as the equations of general relativity and those of quantum mechanics, as applied to the known particles of nature. But such recognizable strings of mathematical characters would be extremely rare. Most books would contain equations no one has previously written down, equations that would normally be deemed pure abstractions. The idea of the ultimate multiverse is to shed this familiar perspective. No longer do most equations lie dormant, with only the lucky few mysteriously coaxed to life through physical instantiation. Instead, every book in the library of mathematical Babel is a real universe. Nozick's suggestion in this mathematical framing provides a concrete answer to a long-debated question. For centuries, mathematicians and philosophers have wondered whether mathematics is discovered or invented. Are mathematical concepts and truths out there, waiting for an intrepid explorer to stumble upon them? Or, since that explorer is more than likely sitting at a desk, pencil in hand, scribbling arcane symbols furiously across a page, are the resulting mathematical concepts and truths invented as part of the mind's search for order and pattern? At first sight, the uncanny way that a great many mathematical insights find application to physical phenomena provides compelling evidence that math is real. Examples abound. From general relativity to quantum mechanics, physicists have found that various mathematical discoveries are tailor-made for physical applications. Paul Dirac's prediction of the positron, the antiparticle of the electron, provides a simple but impressive case in point. In 1931, upon solving his quantum equations for the motion of electrons, Dirac found that the math provided an extraneous solution, apparently describing the motion of a particle just like the electron, except that it carried a positive electric charge, whereas the electron's charge is negative. In 1932, that very particle was discovered by Carl Anderson through a close study of cosmic rays bombarding Earth from space. What began as Dirac's manipulation of mathematical symbols in his notebooks concluded in the laboratory with the experimental discovery of the first species of antimatter. The skeptic can counter, however, that mathematics still emanates from us. We were shaped by evolution to find patterns in the environment. The better we could do that, the better we could predict how to find the next meal. Mathematics, the language of pattern, emerged from our biological fitness. And with that language, we've been able to systematize the search for new patterns, going well beyond those relevant for mere survival. But mathematics, like any of the tools we developed and utilized through the ages, is a human invention. My view on mathematics periodically changes. When I'm in the throes of a mathematical investigation that's going well, I often feel that the process is one of discovery, not invention. I know of no more exciting experience than watching the disparate pieces of a mathematical puzzle suddenly coalesce into a single coherent picture. When it happens, there's a feeling that the picture was there all along, like a grand vista hidden by the morning fog. On the other hand, when I more objectively survey mathematics, I'm less convinced. Mathematical knowledge is the literary output of humans conversant in the unusually precise language of mathematics. And as is surely the case with literature produced in one of the world's natural languages, mathematical literature is the product of human ingenuity and creativity. That's not to say that other intelligent life forms wouldn't come upon the same mathematical results we've found. They very well might. But that could easily reflect similarities in our experiences, such as the need to count, the need to trade, the need to survey, and so on. And so would provide minimal evidence that math has a transcendent existence. A number of years ago, in a public debate on the subject, I said that I could imagine an alien encounter during which, in response to learning of our scientific theories, the aliens remark, "Oh, math. Yeah, we tried that for a while. At first it seemed promising, but ultimately it was a dead end. Here, let us show you how it really works." But to continue with my own vacillation, I don't know how the aliens would actually finish the sentence. And with a broad enough definition of mathematics, for example, logical deductions following from a set of assumptions, I'm not even sure what kind of answers wouldn't amount to math. The ultimate multiverse is unequivocal on the issue. All math is real.